Epilogue. Shoawthal Tirditi and Dora Gardo exchanged grim looks after Regis finished talking.
"So how are they?"
asked Dora Gardo, the leader of the Grinning Ponies, halfling protectors of the tradeway.
"Caddy Bree thinks Drizzt should have died," Regis said. "She couldn't believe that he had somehow defeated the demon poison and hadn't bled to death. The tail spike got him inside the thigh, right in the bloody area."
The other two halflings nodded solemnly.
"He learned some tricks in Damara, it would seem," said Regis. "Our kneebreaker friends have told many stories of the monks of the Monastery of the Yellow Rose,"
Shoawthal explained, his voice rising in reverence when he spoke of the halfling legion that had come down from Damara to join the Grinning Ponies as defenders of Bleeding Vines.
"I've heard such things as you describe." "Zagnafane is worse," Regis went on. "He took many serious wounds." "Oh, but if Drizzt is to lose his father again—"
Dora Gardo started to reply, but Regis shook his head.
"Catty Bree has him on the mend." "And what of the fancy one?" asked Shoawthal with a sigh of relief. "Jarlaxle?" Regis replied, chuckling. "Not a scratch. Never a scratch." "He's not natural, that one, even for a drow," said Dora Gardo. "A dangerous enemy." "But a fine friend," Regis assured them, and the two soldiers nodded. "Have you been to King Brunner?" asked Dora Gardo. "Both he and Jarlaxle have taken the loss of Athrogate and Amber Grisolo Maul terribly. Drizzt, too. There's a lot of history between them, and they'll not soon be forgotten. Nor will the demons and dwarves that killed them." "Hear, hear to that," said Dora Gardo, and all raised their glasses in quiet salute. "Fine, then. What's our move?"
Shoawthal Tirditi asked.
"To Waterdeep, and to all the farms around," Regis explained. "Warn the folk and the lords of Waterdeep." "Just south, then?"
"Luskin knows," Regis explained.
"What about Port Last and the farms north?" Dora Gardo asked.
"Jarlaxle will warn the areas north," Regis told him. "You've only 20 riders, and getting word to Waterdeep is most important, as well as most delicate. Avoid passing through the region around Neverwinter City at all costs. Lord Neverember is not to be trusted, nor are any working for him. I will go so far as to say that he is the biggest problem here."
"Where to tell that to the lords of Waterdeep?" Dora Gardo asked.
"No," Regis replied immediately. "That's why this is so delicate, and why we'll entrust it only to you and yours. We can't accuse a noted and powerful Waterdavian lord like Daggled Neverember on just the evidence we've found so far. And how would we know the full extent of his alliances in any case? He has allied with House Margaster, that much we know. But beyond that, it is wise to assume he has other powerful friends in Waterdeep."
"No," he went on. "We'll keep the conversation to the demons that have taken root in Thornhold, and rally the legions of Waterdeep to help us destroy that threat."
"You've told us of demons in Neverwinter City and Neverwinter Wood as well," Shoawthal reminded him. "You would have us make no mention of that?"
"In time," Regis advised. "We start with Thornhold, then circle out to Neverwinter City. When we have the full confidence of the lords of Waterdeep and have ascertained the whole conspiracy, we will speak to them of House Margaster and, in time, of Lord Neverember and his money-washing."
The two riders looked at each other again and nodded.
"As you wish, Spider Paraffin," Dora Gardo said. "We set out for Waterdeep with the morning's first light."
Regis nodded his appreciation. He knew that his friends had a long and difficult road ahead of them. He knew that all the folk of the North had a long and difficult road ahead of them. Brevington Margaster stood at the prow of the Carrick White Seal, the lead ship in the pirate flotilla, sailing north on the southern winds as spring took hold along the Sword Coast. 100 ships followed, sloops and caravels, carracks and even a pair of longboats, including one oared by giant refugee firbolgs from the Moonshae Isles. More than 2,000 men, women, giant kind, goblinkin, even a crew of gnolls, rode these winds right behind him, eager for plunder. The young nobleman grinned. This great armada had been hired for a fraction of the vast Margaster fortune, and less than the price of any mercenaries Brevenden had ever heard of. So eager were they for new plunder in the north, above Waterdeep.
and so eager to reclaim Luskin from the secret powers behind the rise of High Captain Kurth. "I told you," said the voice in Brevenden's head, the voice of the demon residing in the phylactery he wore about his neck.
"You did," the man admitted, "and know that House Margaster and Lord Neverember will not forget it.
You know what I want."
"Yes, Asbeel."
"Have they fashioned our sword?"
Brevenden glanced back to starboard, far aft, to a heavy carrack and the smoke that poured from her raised bridge. "They work on it," he told the demon, "large and twisted and jagged."
"And the gem I gave you? The adamantine, too?"
"Yes, of course," he assured his visitor. "All is being done in accordance with the guide you helped me pen."
"Too large for you, my host. But when I am free, you will learn the power of that blade," the Cambion promised.
"We've a bigger problem than Lord Neverember, I fear," Jarlaxle told King Brunner, in the dwarf's private quarters deep within Gontalgrim. Beside the dwarf, his two queens, Fist and Fury, grumbled about revenge for the death of Amber Grisolo Maul, who had become a dear friend to them.
"Mayhap, but I've been wanting that one's head for a long time," Brunner replied, not seeming to hear Jarlaxle.
"Demons," the rogue tried.
"Fought 'em afore."
"Indeed, but in such numbers?" asked the drow. "I have not seen so many demons in one place outside of the Underdark or the Abyss itself. And among them are major fiends who can open gates to the lower planes and bring forth more minions still."
Brunner cocked his head and looked at the drow sidelong.
"Guess I'm not surprised," he muttered.
"Surprised?
That ye been to the Abyss? Searching for a vacation home, were ye?"
That brought a smile to Jarlaxle's face, but it didn't last.
"We must act quickly, or their numbers will multiply," the drow warned.
"I've gates of me own," Brunner replied.
"And I fear you will need them, good dwarf," Jarlaxle said. "All of them."
"Waterdeep won't sit back," said Brunner. "The whole of the North's in danger, and last I looked, demons ain't much caring what or who they're murdering and eating."
"We know not who in the city is allied with us, and who with Lord Neverember," Jarlaxle admitted, offering a shrug, almost an apology. Brunner surely understood. Yes, the lords of Waterdeep might now tolerate demons in the lands about their grand city, but they weren't overly fond of drow elves controlling Luskin either, nor of the magical host tower being raised from the rubble, led by a former archmage of Menzo Baranzon. Brunner's known friendship with Jarlaxle had not helped him enlist many allies in his running feud with Lord Dagalt Neverember, who was, after all, a lord of Waterdeep himself. Indeed, in the months of Gontalgrim's renewal, Brunner had been quite surprised to discover how isolated he and his clan had become from the area's powers. He figured relations would improve now that the magical teleportation gates were working, and goods from Mithril Hall, Citadel Adbar, and Citadel Felbar would soon be flowing through Gontalgrim, to say nothing of the weapons being fashioned by expert blacksmiths at Brunner's primordial fired forge. But that was still in the future, and the demons were in the present, and the past... well, the past always lingered, and old habits and prejudices died hard.
"I want to kill them as much as you do," Jarlaxle offered then. "Atherogate was not only your friend."
"Aye," Brunner admitted. "Nor Amber, I know. To be certain, I'm still not knowing how much I should trust ye, elf, on the little matters, particularly when coin or magic's in the pot, eh? But when the fight started, I'm glad you're on me side."
Jarlaxle bowed and tipped his hat.
"And what help from the host tower?" Brunner asked. "Them wizards shouldn't much like demons that ain't their own to play with."
"Those wizards who are about will aid us, I am sure. And we will need them, I am just as sure."
Brunner wanted to counter that with some words about Jarlaxle never really seeing the wrath of Clan Battlehammer unleashed. He held the thought private, though, fearing that his voice wouldn't be so convincing. Atherogate was gone. Amber Grisolo Maul of the Adbaro Mauls was gone. And his friends had just limped home with severe wounds to tell him that news. He expected that Clan Battlehammer was about to find the fight of their lives, probably even beyond the catastrophe of the War of the Silver Marches. he would soon enough learn that he was underestimating his enemies.
"It will get worse," Ashala Milarn said to Kimuriel O'Blodra, her parting words as the psionicist became insubstantial and drifted through the wall of the Underdark corridor where they had secretly met. A large part of Ashala wanted to go with him. Her prospects in Menzo Baranzon were not good. She had been the ambassador of her house to both Bregan D'Earth and House Zor-Lauren, but now House Zor-Lauren was no more, or would soon be again, but in the place of fallen House Do'Urden, and at the sufferance of and alliance with House Bayenry. House Milarn, which had openly attacked House Do'Urden, was no more in the favor of the Zor-Laurens, and particularly not with the Bayenrys. And the Bayenrys were also the great protectors of Bregan D'Earth. Where did that leave Ashala? She was the third daughter of the first priestess Kirnil. Once her prospects were grand, for Kirnil was then Matron Kirnil Kennethan. But Jindia Holbar was now their matron. Her grip had never been tighter, and Kirnil's place had never been less important or less stable. If Kirnil fell, her daughters would find themselves at Jindia's mercy. And Jindia, Ashala understood, was not possessed of that particular quality. She almost called back to the departing psionicist to beg him to take her with him to join with Jarlaxle. She did not, though, mostly because she knew that Kimuriel would not do it. She was more important to Bregan D'Earth where she was, seated beside the powers of House Milarn, than she could be as just another member of the mercenary band. So she sighed instead and made her way back to the city in House Milarn. She was barely through the front gates when a sentry informed her that the matron was looking for her regarding an urgent matter. She rushed through the house, a bit concerned, and found Matron Jindia in her private quarters, sitting in a comfortable chair beside First Priestess Kirnil.
"I was told you would see me," she said, bowing respectfully. "I have gained a bit more information about the plans of Matron Zira Zor-Lar—"
"Have you?" Matron Jindia interrupted, seeming quite amused, which of course had the hairs on the back of Ashala's neck standing up. Her fears became a horrible reality a moment later, when a quartet of guards, including the house wizard, came through a side door with a floating disc, upon which lay Kimuriel O'Blodra, shackled to the disc by strands of energy across the wrists, ankles, waist, and neck. One more shackle, a living shackle, by far the most horrific and gruesome, held the psionicist captive. For coming in behind the disc was an illithid, two of its octopus-like tentacles up Kimuriel's nose.
"My matron," Ashala began.
"Do not even bother to speak," Matron Jindia interrupted. "We know it all. And if there is more to be learned, my mind-flayer friend there will simply take it from you." She motioned to the open door, and more drow entered the room, Ashala's fellow priestesses of House Milarn. They surrounded her and led her into a different room, and the young woman's knees went weak indeed when she came to that destination. It was a small chamber with only a single item within, a large metal tub filled with water. An armrest extended from each side of the basin, complete with straps and culminating in pillywinks.
"No, no, no," Ashala begged, and the strength left her legs. Her sisters caught her before she hit the ground, though, and stripped her naked as they held her up. Then they dragged her into the tub and strapped her arms down to either side.
Matron Jindia and Ashala's mother had entered the room by this point, and Jindia looked to Kirnil in motion, saying, "You should apply the thumbscrews, First Priestess, to show your devotion to Lolth above your family." Ashala could see the pain on her mother's face as she screwed down the poor girl's fingers. But with that pain came, too, a measure of outrage that stupid Ashala had ever put her in this position. Thus, when Kirnil tightened down the vice, she offered no mercy, crushing Ashala's fingers under its brutal press. While that was transpiring, others began to paint Ashala's face and neck with Rothay milk and honey, a sweet and gooey mixture. They all stepped back, leaving Ashala sobbing when Matron Jindia leaned over to stare into her face. "Fear not, child, for you'll be fed well," she said, "and I will bring the flies to you personally." Ashala began to beg and to wail, to thrash and tug against the straps holding her arms fast, but Jindia just laughed,
and twisted down one of the pillywinks to elicit a scream of absolute agony.
"Fetch the illithid, that it can extract all we need from this one's mind," Matron Jindia ordered one of the others, and she quickly turned back to Ashala and gave the thumbscrews another agonizing turn.
"Pain tells you that you are alive, child," she purred in sobbing Ashala's ear. "That is a good thing. You see, I want you to enjoy the many meals we will feed to you. I want you alive when the flies are feasting on the milk and honey. I want you alive when you are lying in this tub of your own excrement. I want you alive when the maggots hatch in the filthy tub all about you, that you can feel every bite and every squirm over the days as they devour you."
He couldn't open his eyes, but he heard a sound, distantly, and soon understood it to be a voice. He knew the language, but not well. "You grant me spells of healing. Why?" the speaker said in a melodic voice, a beautiful voice, he thought. "These are your enemies. Is your highest quality that of unpredictability?" He didn't understand the next words. They were in the same language, he guessed from the inflections and consonant sounds, but seemed more ancient somehow. Then he felt the warmth, as a wave of healing washed through him, aimed at his lower arm. And only then did the broken fellow realize the acute pain in that area. "I betrayed you," the voice said, ending in a laugh that seemed helpless. He managed to crack open one eye, hardly focusing, and saw a beautiful drow woman standing over him. He tried to speak her name, or who he thought her to be, but could find no breath behind the word to speak it audibly. "I stole Zacnaphane from eternity to deliver him to the heretic who denied you. And yet you grant me spells," she said, shaking her head, her thick white hair flying about. "And you grant me spells of healing for these, your enemies."
"What are ye about?"
Athrogate managed to ask. She looked down at him with purple eyes.
"Rest easy. You should be dead. You were on the edge of the grave."
He couldn't have resisted that suggestion if he wanted to, for despite the healing she had given to him from whatever god, he couldn't deny a great weariness, one bordering on death indeed. This is Victor Bavine. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Timeless, a Drizzt novel by R.A. Salvatore. Presented by William Morrow and Harper Audio. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer, Iris McElroy. Text copyright 2018 by Wizards of the Coast, LLC. Production copyright 2018 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.